Good afternoon and welcome to Tom Harris USA, episode number 54. This is Tom Harris in Chicago, Illinois, and I'm trying a little fun experiment. And I know other people have done things like this, but this is my first kind of little stab at it. Remember when you were a kid? And I think maybe a lot of us have done this, especially if we've lived near a river or the ocean or a lake or whatever. You take a bottle, like a pop bottle, and you put a note in it and throw it into the lake and hope that it floats somewhere and somebody gets your note and answers it. The concept is familiar. I'm sure everybody knows this from the popular media or whatever. I actually am doing something similar to that with a book. Now, I've heard of people doing it with books, too, and they'll take a book and they'll write their name in it and say, pass this book along. And so I'm trying that right now, and what I did was I took a book. Now, the book was a book by Chinua Achebe called Things Fall Apart. And it's a really good book. I mean, it's been around for a long time, and it's about a group of Africans, a tribe of Africans living in the Niger Valley. I'm not going to explain the plot of the book. I mean, if you're interested, you can actually go and get the book out of the library or something. Can't recommend it highly enough, because it actually talks about a breakdown of the society being caused by people from the outside, in this case, colonialists and missionaries. So anyway, I had this copy of the book laying around my apartment, and what I had decided to do is I wrote my name in the front. I put a little note, and the note says, please feel free to take this book, read it, enjoy it, and pass it along to somebody else. And then I put in my name and my web address, www.tomharrisusa.com. And I'm just kind of see where it goes and see if maybe anybody out there finds this and tunes into the show. I mean, obviously, if this were actually a way to find new listeners for the show, it would probably be an utter failure, because how many people is this book going to reach? But I will say, if you are a person who has found this book and has read it and has checked out the show, welcome. Welcome to Tom Harris USA. And hopefully you'll have enjoyed Things Fall Apart as much as I did, and you will go ahead and pass it along to somebody else who may enjoy it, and put your name and your email address or your city or whatever in there, and people can kind of follow where the book goes. I kind of did stuff like this when I was traveling, and this would have been back in 96, and I did an 8-month jaunt in Europe, and I was going from hostel to hostel. And a lot of these hostels will have a bookshelf where you can leave a book, take a book, that sort of thing. And I took full advantage of that. And over this 8-month period, I read like 30 books. I mean, it was not a real small amount of books. And some of the books were very light reading, like Swiss Family Robinson, sort of a kid's classic. And then others were more dense and more difficult to read. I know there was a Solzhenitsyn, how do you pronounce that? Solzhenitsyn book in there. There was also a book in there called The Kingdom, which was a history of Saudi Arabia. Very, very, very interesting book. Anyway, there were a lot of books there that I read. And what I would do is I would take them with me when I left the hostel and travel to whatever town I was going to next. And, so when I finished a book, wherever I was, I would take the book and I would leave it in the hostel. Usually there's a bookshelf that's dedicated to reading, and people leave stuff there all the time. And sometimes there'd be something else there that I'd be interested in, and I'd take it with me, and sometimes there wouldn't. And a couple of times I even bought books. I think the one that I bought was The Lost World by Michael Crichton, the sequel to Jurassic Park. And read that, and I left that in a hostel somewhere. And I didn't think at the time to put my email address inside the book or anything, so people could actually get in touch with me. But it was sort of like a traveling library, and there were some books that traveled pretty far. It'd be interesting if they're still there. Go back to the hostels and see if the books are still there. Anyway, what I noticed that I took down to the coffee shop, local coffee shop, this book. And they have a bookshelf there that has a lot of books on it. And I noticed that the books change. They do go through a cycle, and I do think that people are taking them and then bringing other books. I don't know if that's really the purpose, but that is what happens. So I left the Achebe book there on the shelf, and I got my coffee. And as I was leaving, I noticed that somebody had it. So I'm hoping that, you know, that they read it and check out the show maybe and pass the book along and go on to the next person. So maybe the journey has started. It'll be interesting to see if we actually get any reply from that experiment. So it's just kind of something fun to try. And I'd be interested in hearing if other people had a similar thing that they were doing and what kind of results they got. And even if you were one of those kids who put a note in a bottle and pitched it into a river, I'd be interested in hearing if that worked out for you, because it's kind of an interesting thing, you know, because of this random people who find messages. And, you know, I had a friend who found a message, and we tracked it down to a girl who lived in our town. And this was one of those note in a bottle things. So I know people do find them, and it's not uncommon. Kind of on a similar vein, there's a project called the Where's George Project, and that's a currency tracking website. And what you do is you enter the serial numbers of your paper currency into the system, and you can choose to mark the bill or not mark the bill as you will with the URL of the website, which is www.wheresgeorge.com. But if you mark the bill, you're going to have a much better result. And what people will do is they'll enter the serial number into the website when they get it, and it'll tell you where the bill has traveled to. And that's something that I've kind of done on and off for a long period of time. And interestingly enough, you know, a lot of people assume that that's illegal, because there's a kind of an urban myth that it's illegal to write on money. And there is a statute that forbids defacing currency, but the statute specifies that it's only illegal if it renders the currency unable to be used as currency. So if you're chopping it up in a shredder, that would be illegal. But putting a rubber stamp on it is not illegal. And I think if you look at money, you'll see that most of the marks that are made on it are actually rubber stamps that are put on them by banks. But just writing your name on it, or, you know, drawing a mustache on Abe Lincoln or whatever, as silly as it is and as ridiculous and pointless as it is, you know, it's not illegal, and you're not going to get arrested for it. It's interesting, because there was a group of epidemiologists who used the wheresgeorge.com data to study the passage, the path of flu virus. And there, I think they were doing a study on whether or not, you know, flu bugs are being spread in the same patterns as currency, because apparently, you know, the currency has patterns like anything else, and the migration pattern varies. It's not completely random. The bills from a certain place tend to end up in a certain other place, and so forth. And epidemiologists find that information useful scientifically in their research. So yes, I've continued to do the Where's George thing. And so if you find bills that say Where's George on it, I encourage you to go in and enter the data and see where that bill has been. Anyway, let me know. The email address, if you want to get in touch with the show, is tom@tomharrisusa.com. I always love feedback. Okay, so welcome to what is a very special segment of Tom Harris USA, because it's not like anything I've ever done on the show before, and probably not like anything I'm ever going to do on this show again. Here we have a segment that I will call Cooking with Tom. And the dish that I'm going to prepare is a dish that I prepare a couple times a year, probably. It's a dish that I invented myself, and I came up with this idea for this back in the mid-90s. I think the first time I ever made it was at a family reunion in 1998. And it is something that has kind of become a signature dish of mine. So if I do often make it for family gatherings, I make it for when I go visit friends and we have to prepare a meal. And so there are certain friends that I visit more often that have had it more often than others. Generally speaking, a pretty popular dish. Enough people, I think, have had it now that I, you know, if it were going to be going spreading around the internet, it probably would have already done so. So I don't feel too bad about actually preparing it on the show. So just for a point of reference, today is Thanksgiving, and I am going to prepare this for my Thanksgiving dinner. So let's actually, I'm cheating a little bit because it's actually the night before Thanksgiving, and I'm going to make the sauce a little bit in advance, and I will continue the segment tomorrow. And well, let's pretend it's all on the same day, because it actually isn't. Okay, so what this dish is, it's a pasta dish, and it's usually what I call my special pasta or ginger pasta, or we could come up with some kind of clever name for it, like I don't know, atheist pasta. That would be good. Yeah, so it'd be Tom Harris USA's atheist pasta. Or you could call it whatever you want, as long as you give me credit. Anyway, so what you need for this, you need a 24-ounce box of pasta. Now, I'm going to start with the pasta because I probably am not going to talk about this again. And the pasta that you get should not be like spaghetti or linguine, something that doesn't have a lot of surface area, because you want to have something that the sauce is going to cling to. This is not the kind of a dish where you pour the sauce over it. It's the kind of dish where you mix the sauce in, and you want the sauce to cling to the pasta. So I usually use bow tie pasta, and I've had my best results with bow tie pasta. I've used other kinds that haven't worked as well. This year, I'm using campanella pasta, and we'll give that a go, and we'll see, because those are like flower-shaped and kind of a little funnel shape, and I'm thinking that maybe the sauce will fill those little funnels and make it more succulent. But normally, I've used the farfalla or the bow tie pasta. That's normally what I've used. I've been threatening for years to make this with wagon wheel pasta, but I just haven't gotten around to it. All I'm going to say about the pasta is you want the pasta to be al dente. You don't want to cook it too long because you want this to coat with the sauce, and you don't want the noodles to fall apart. So you want them to be firm enough that they're not going to fall apart. So I would recommend that you maybe cook these a little bit firmer than you normally would, because you don't want little bits breaking off. Okay? Okay. So I think we've kind of done with the pasta there. And I won't mention this again until later. Okay, so for the sauce, what you're going to need, a large onion. And I normally use white onions for this. But this year, I'm actually trying something a little bit different. And I think I have my best results, though, with white onions. This year, I'm using a red onion. And this was the recommendation of Pete, who was telling me that the red onion might add some tartness to it that is normally not really there. So it's worth a go. You know, I'll let you guys know how mine turns out. But I would say if you're making this for the first time, use a white onion, and a fairly large one, bigger than a baseball but smaller than a softball. Does that make any sense? Or a little smaller than a cricket ball if you're in the UK. Okay, the other thing you'll need is a bulb of garlic, about a medium-sized bulb of garlic. You want something that's going to be, it's going to give you about 6 or 7 good-sized cloves once you break it apart. Okay, and the last thing that you're going to need for the mash, as I call it, is a fresh ginger root. And I usually get a piece of fresh ginger root that is about the size of my hand. So pretty big piece, and it can have, you know, several fingers or not, depending on what you can find. Now, I will say, when you're picking out your ginger root, you want to make sure that it's not wrinkly, because wrinkly ginger root, it means that it's been sitting around for a while and it's gotten a little bit dried out. You don't want that, because you want some moisture in your ginger root for when you're cooking it, because you're going to actually end up cooking this in a big fry pan. Okay, so you want to get a piece of freshest ginger you can find. Now, if you really hate ginger, and you really hate garlic, and you really hate onion, this is not a dish for you, because it has a lot of all three. Okay, so next step is you need a large fry pan or skillet, something that you can, you're actually going to saute these ingredients. So make sure you have that. And I always use olive oil to do my sautéing in. I hate olives normally, but cooking with olive oil is okay, and it doesn't really add any olivey taste to it, so that's fine. Okay, so the first thing I usually do is I a peel and chop the onion. So I have right now a peeled onion that has been chopped up. Now, you don't want to chop it up too small, because you want chunks of onion. You actually, and these chunks of onion are gonna shrink while you're sautéing them. So you want to do that. So what I would do is I chop up your onion, and you want to have, you know, nice little chunks of onion. Not too big and not too small, just sort of medium-sized chunks of onion. Okay, and you put that and any juice that you have left over on your cutting board into the skillet. Okay, next thing I usually do is I grate the ginger root. And okay, so ginger has the skin on it, and obviously you don't want that as part of your thing. So what I do at this point is I break the ginger root up and separate the fingers, because you know ginger quite often looks like a little hand, you know, and has fingers. All right, so you break the fingers off, and then I use a carrot peeler or potato peeler to just skin the skin off, the kind of it's kind of barky skin on it. You throw that away. You don't actually use that, but don't peel it like you'd peel a carrot or you'd peel a lot of it off. You just want to scrape the skin off, and that's really all you need to do is just to scrape that skin off. And with ginger, sometimes you get little hard bits, and you want to cut those off and just cut as little off as you can. So you'll end up with several, you know, largish pieces of ginger root that have already had the skin peeled off of them. Now, I use a cheese grater. It's a little handheld cheese grater. We'll grate things pretty small. It would not be like the big cheese grater that you'd use like for pizza. It's a smaller handheld one. And sometimes the big cheese graters will have size of grater on the side. So you grate the ginger using that, and you want to grate all of it. Now you're going to end up with little fibrous bits that you know that are left over from where you're holding on to the ginger root. And a few of these fibers are going to end up in your sauce as well, but it's not anything to worry about. There's nothing wrong with them. They're soft enough to eat, and they don't get stuck in your teeth or anything. If you're serving this to a little kid or something, and they're going to say, "Oh, mommy, there's strings in my food," you just tell them, you know, shut up and eat your string, okay? When you're grating it, though, you're going to have a lot of fiber, so you don't want to have too much fiber. So just take any excess fiber and just kind of throw it away. You shouldn't end up throwing very much of this away, because normally you could use it all. And I also grate up the garlic. And after you peel the bulb of garlic and you get the cloves out, you grate all of those cloves along with the ginger and kind of have that big pile of soppy ginger and garlic grated up. You can also use a garlic press. If you prefer to use sort of the diced garlic in the jar, you can use that too, but I generally don't. I usually use it fresh. If you have access to a food processor, you can use that as well. And in that case, what I would recommend you do is chop the ginger up into smaller pieces. And I would say pieces that are about the size of your garlic cloves. And then you would put that in your food processor and you know, grind them up. Now, you don't want to grind that up too small. You don't want to turn it into a puree. You want to actually have some texture to that. So you will have this sort of fibrous mass, okay? And that's okay, because that's what you want. Okay, so now that you've ground up your ginger and your garlic, you put it into the skillet with the onion, and you should have about half and half, half onion and half ginger and garlic combined. If you're making this dish for the first time and you're looking at this big pile of ginger and onion, you're probably thinking to yourself, "Oh my God, there's no way I'm going to put that in my mouth. It's just too much, and it's like has this really kind of sharp smell to it and very spicy smell to it." Don't worry about it, because you're going to cook it and it's going to reduce down. And now you want to, at this point, you want to turn on your skillet, your fry pan, whatever, and you want to saute this. And what will happen is that this will actually reduce down in size. It won't be as much of the mash. It'll get smaller. And you want to saute this down. Right now my apartment smells like onion, which is fantastic. I love the smell of cooking onion. You want it to kind of saute this. Now you don't want to have the heat on your fry pan too hot. And the reason why is because you don't want to caramelize the onion. Some of the onion will be caramelized in the process, because you want to actually cook this for a while. And it's hard to know when it's actually done. but you'll know when it's done. It should all be the same color, and it'll have this really nice, spicy, pungent smell that'll kind of fill your house. Okay, so now that you have that, now you need sauce. And now, if you're Martha Stewart, or if you are a big fan of homemade sauce, then you can use a homemade tomato-based sauce for this. You can also make this without tomatoes. Generally speaking, I do a tomato-based sauce. I don't have any problem with that. And because I'm lazy, I usually buy a jar sauce, like Classico, something cheap. It doesn't really matter. I think I've had the best results with the three cheese sauce or the four cheese sauce. And I've used, Classico, and I've used Ragu. But you want a chunky style sauce. I've used Newman's Own is another one I've used. And I'll have to say, your results may vary. Now, you can certainly use homemade sauce if you want. It doesn't kind of matter what flavor you get, because anything in there is going to get overpowered by the garlic and the ginger and the onion. So I don't recommend getting like a caramelized onion and roasted garlic flavor sauce, because there's quite enough of that in there already. So, okay, now, the one thing that you're doing while you're cooking your hash, because it actually kind of looks like hash, and I call it mush or hash or whatever, I usually add something a little extra at this point. Now, what I usually add, I use a little bit of black pepper, and then I'll add a little bit of something alcoholic. The best results I've had is when I use a little bit of hard cider. Not much, just a couple little splashes of hard cider. And I usually put that in when it gets to the point where there's not a lot of liquid left in the pot. And that actually does add a little bit of flavor to it. Now, if you're going to add cider to it, folks, don't get like White Diamond or something that has a real high alcohol content, because that is too sour. I would recommend probably like a Magners, a nice, decent quality cider. I think the first time that I made this dish, I used Woodchuck. But it doesn't matter. You're not going to put that much in anyway, but I would definitely recommend something with a lower alcohol content, or even a homebrew cider if you make cider at home. So I quite enjoy that. Add that little bit of flavor to that. Okay, so having done that, it smells wonderful. Now, what I did this year is I used a little bit of single malt whiskey. And I have done that before, and it's turned out quite well. And I used a little bit of Lafroy whiskey this year. That actually adds a little bit of a smoky taste to it, which I quite like. And, of course, all the alcohol gets cooked off. Now, you want to be really, really careful, if you're going to use whiskey, not to have your heat turned up too high. Because otherwise, you could catch your whiskey on fire, and that would create a big mess. So you don't want to do that. Okay, so at this point you should have your skillet with the hash on it of the ginger and onion and garlic, and then you also have a pot of sauce, and it doesn't matter if it's a jar sauce or homemade or whatever. I think homemade would be really good. I've never done it that way because I don't make homemade sauce because I'm lazy. Okay, so then you put the mush into the saucepan with your sauce, and you cook it for a while. You actually let it simmer, and I usually let it simmer for about 15 minutes to a half an hour, just to get it done. Now, if you're going to prepare this right away, which I'm not because I'm cooking the sauce the night before, then this is where you'd put on your pasta to cook right after you set that to simmer. I tell you what I found is that you can let the sauce sit overnight and let it kind of marinate and let the flavors blend a little bit. And that actually will cut down a lot of the spiciness from the ginger, and you'll actually end up with, I think, a little bit more garlicky taste in the end. You could actually serve it, almost right away, after you've cooked, you simmered it for a half an hour. One of the advantages of this dish is that it doesn't take long to make. And I think the main difference you're going to find that if you let the flavors blend a little bit, it becomes a little bit milder. But if you serve it right away, you're going to have a little bit of bite to it. Now, I quite like that little bite, but some people might not. So that's just something to keep in mind. So at this point, you'd be making your pasta. Now, you want to make sure that your pasta doesn't get overcooked, like I said before. And you want to have this pasta to be al dente. So, okay, so moving on ahead. The pasta now should be done. Assuming you cooked it for about 10-15 minutes, and it should be firm, not mushy. You don't want mushy pasta. That wouldn't be good. Now, this campanella that I used, this is actually Thanksgiving Day now, by the way. The campanella that I used actually took longer to cook. I'm not quite sure why that is. Maybe because it's kind of folded over itself. And it is kind of a little bit more chewy than most pasta, so you want to maybe cook that a little longer. Now, what I did with the sauce is after I simmered it for about 15 minutes, is I put it in the refrigerator and let it sit overnight and blend the flavors a little bit. So now, at this point, I've got my pasta and it's sitting on the stove and it looks like it's about done. So what I've done is I've taken the pasta out and I've heated it up again, let it simmer a little while longer. Okay, so at this point, you want to drain your pasta if it's done. And my kitchen is right now full of steam. You'll notice I'm not doing this from the kitchen. And the reason why is because the headset doesn't reach all the way into the kitchen. So I'm coming running back over to the computer and doing a little bit more recording each time. Okay, so now you have your pasta, which is cooked and drained. And you cook, it's perfect right now. The texture is perfect. And now you have the sauce. And what you do is you take the drained pasta, which is in a colander, make sure that it doesn't have too much water in it, and you put it back in your pasta pot after you dumped all the water out of it. And then you pour the entire pot of sauce over the pasta, in the pasta pot, and you make sure that is well mixed. Now, at this point, you sample it and see if it needs a little bit of seasoning. You can add a little bit of pepper. I do recommend pepper. A little bit of oregano is quite nice. I wouldn't recommend salt, but I never add salt to anything, so it's just me. And that's pretty much it. Now there's a couple variations you can do. Now, this is, as you can tell, this is a vegetarian dish. And if you use the right kind of pasta, it's even a vegan dish. I don't really care about the vegan aspect of it. I have not tried this dish with meat, but I suppose it's possible to make it with meat. I don't know what that would do as far as the mixture of spices and so forth. But if anybody tries that, they can let me know how it turned out. And I'll pass your word along to other people. Okay, so at this point, the dish is complete, and the kitchen smells fantastic. It's just really good. And I've sampled it, and I've noticed that it's a little bit less spicy than normal. And I think that has to do with the fact that I left the sauce to marinate in the refrigerator overnight before I took it out and finished simmering it. And I suppose for a lot of people that'll be okay because they might not like things as spicy as I do. This is not a hot dish, but it does kind of creep up on you if you're not careful. Okay, so there's a couple advantages to this dish. And one of the things about this dish that I think would appeal to a lot of people is that, A, it doesn't take very long to prepare. Maybe half an hour to 45 minutes to prepare. The other thing about it, it's a very, very inexpensive dish to make. None of the ingredients in this are expensive. Now, if you live in a kind of a rural area, you might have trouble finding fresh ginger, but I would think that would probably be the only real difficulty. All the other ingredients are easy to come by and very, very inexpensive. And that's it. That's basically it. Now, this will serve, if you are serving it as a main course, about four people, four hungry people. So say four to six people that this will serve. If you're using it as a side dish, this is like eight servings. So this is quite a bit of pasta here. And this will last me probably for a couple of days. Anyhow, that's Cooking with Tom and his Tom Harris USA Atheist Pasta. So have a good Thanksgiving, everybody. I hope you all had a good holiday, and I'll be back next week, and we'll talk about other stuff. So thanks a lot. This is Tom Harris. I'm Tom Harris USA signing off.